The underlying theme of our program today, as well as our previous recording, Speaking the Lost Language of God, is that through our thoughts, feelings, emotions, and beliefs, from within us, we communicate with our world and our bodies in what, for some people, are surprising and unexpected ways. Well, today, many in the scientific community now acknowledge this very relationship, largely because of the following discoveries. Facts that were unheard of in the world of science as recently as 25 years ago. What we know today, for example, the fact, we know that we are bathed in a field of intelligent energy. And while the field may have different names, and we are still struggling to understand what it means, scientists, for the large part, acknowledge the existence of this field. Number two, we know that DNA, the DNA within every cell of our bodies, communicates directly with this field. While we may not understand precisely how far this relationship exists, the research in the laboratories and accredited scientific and academic institutions has shown beyond doubt that this phenomenon exists. DNA directly influences the field of energy. Number three, we know that the energy directly responds to the language of human emotion. What we become, our thoughts, feelings, emotions, beliefs, perceptions, as we've said so many times in this program, we're emphasizing it because this is the key. What we become in our inner world is the language that this field responds to. It's the language that this field acknowledges and understands. Although our actions may be very well intended, it's the thought, feeling, and emotion underlying the actions that are the actual field that is being responded to. Well, in the 21st century, we may find that this is precisely the message. These relationships that describe how we fit in this world, in this creation, in this universe, with the forces of energy that we're only beginning to understand. In this new century, we may find that this is precisely the message that was left for us as a mystery of our time. A mystery that so far the best science has failed to solve. It's within the context of these understandings that the unsolved mystery of what is called the Shroud of Turin begins to take on new meaning and give even greater significance in our effort to answer the lingering question, who are we? So for the next portion of our program, what I'd like to do is update you on the studies of the ancient Shroud of Turin, studies that were conducted in the late 20th century and are ongoing. Many of these studies were in fact published. However, they were published in obscure technical journals, and the studies were fragmented into very specific journals, the journals of spectroscopy, for example, or the journals of forensic pathology, journals that would not typically make it to our newsstands or front page headlines. So I'd like to share an update with you on some of these studies. On the one hand, on the other hand, I'm going to be using the Shroud as an example of how the mirror of life may respond to the power within our bodies. So for many of our listeners, I know you are familiar with the Shroud, and there are always people who say to me, what is the Shroud of Turin? So I'd like to share with you what this Shroud is, because my sense is, although you may not have heard the precise name, I'm sure you're familiar with the concept, because it is so permeated pictures in media over the past few years, very, very current in some of the news that's happening right now. The Shroud of Turin, it's a single sheet of linen measuring about 14.5 feet long by about 3.5 feet wide. On this sheet of linen, it is emblazoned with the image of a man, both front and back, both the front and the back of his body, a man that had been crucified in ancient times, a man that many people believe to be the body of Jesus of Nazareth. And while the existence of the Shroud can be traced back many centuries, it was only in the 20th century the Catholic Church in Turin, Italy, where the Shroud resides today, granted permission for a team of scientists to begin an extensive study of the Shroud itself. I'll say right up front before we begin this discussion, we may never know precisely who the man in the Shroud really was, because there simply is no test for Jesus per se. It's not like we can find a certain number of parameters, add them together, and the test says plus, it's Jesus, or minus, it's not. What we will see, however, is that from the results of the studies, There has been no evidence to date that prevents the shroud from being the burial cloth that covered the body of Jesus 2,000 years ago. I think this is an important statement to make. Of the five criteria that were evaluated by the scientific teams, the test results are all consistent with the historical information that described Jesus' ordeal in the Roman courts, described the condition of his body before, during, and after his crucifixion. So whether this is, in fact, an image of the man we know as the historical Jesus or not, on the one hand, while it is important to many of us from our spiritual and religious beliefs, on the other hand, it may be less important from the perspective of our program today. Because whether the man in the shroud was Jesus or not, he was a human. And something happened to that man, something happened to one of us, one of our species, in the past, that is so mysterious on the one hand, we cannot explain it today with the traditional science and the explanations that have been used to explain things in the past, while on the other hand, if it happened to one person, it means that there's a power that was within each of us, and that may in fact, as we'll see, be the message in the shroud. Well, the scientific studies looked at a number of criteria, five key criteria to determine who was in the shroud and whether or not the shroud is authentic. And I'll mention these criteria now. Then I'm going to go through and simply share with you, in some cases technically and in some cases through the words and the reports of the researchers themselves, what has been determined within the context of these five parameters. One of the questions on the shroud, on the authenticity of the shroud, is whether or not there is any blood on the shroud. And if there is blood, is it human blood? Another criteria, the second, is how old is the cloth itself? Can it be dated to the time of Jesus or even perhaps the time before Jesus? Could it have been 100 years or so old by the time of Jesus' crucifixion? The third criteria is the description of the wounds from the man in the shroud and how closely they parallel those described in historic texts. The fourth criteria is relatively recent and is the study of the pollen grains within the fibers of the shroud itself. And what we know is that on a microscopic level, when cloth or any material travels from one location of the world to another, if it's been exposed to nature, it will pick up and carry evidence of that nature with it wherever it goes, including the grains of pollen from plants that lived during the time that the object was in a certain location. So we'll look at the pollen grains, and the last is the burial customs of the time. Does the body match the description of the way that people of Jesus' faith were buried at the time of the crucifixion and conform to the standards of those Hebrew traditions? And then the sixth and final piece of information that we will look at is the looming question, how was the image on the shroud even formed? What is it that would cause the image of the man to be emblazoned upon the shroud in a way that is controversial even today? Well, the images of the shroud being associated with the body of Jesus were first seen in illustrations, biblical illustrations, during the 13th and 14th century. There are color sheets in the illuminated texts of the ancient Bibles that show Jesus being taken down from the cross and covered with a sheet of linen from head to toe, a continuous sheet that is open at his feet, and it moves underneath his body, comes over the top of his head, and then is laid gently across the front of his body down to his feet, covering his feet once again. And in the same page, after the crucifixion, that shroud is being shown unfolded by the angels of the heavens after the resurrection. The angels are holding the shroud, and the shroud is very clearly depicting the image of a man, both from the front of his body and the back of his body, being emblazoned upon the shroud. Well, the mystery in modern times, the mystery of the shroud first surfaced in 1898 with the invention of some of the first cameras. Because the shroud, when you look at it with the naked eye, while you can see the image of the man, both front and back, on the shroud. He is portrayed as lying with his hands crossed in front of his lower abdomen, his feet together, his face is upright, it's facing forward. And when the cameras first took this picture in 1898, the shroud itself appears to be a negative. It looks like the reverse of an image if you were to depict this image as an artist. Well, to the surprise of the photographers in 1898, when they photographed the shroud for the very first time and they developed the image that resulted was a positive image, as if the shroud were in fact a negative on film, just the way we would use it today. And with this positive image, all the values were reversed. What had been dark became light. What had been light became dark. And all of a sudden, tremendous detail was able to be discerned from the image in the man in the shroud. And this began the studies that are leading to the controversies today. Well, the way that the shroud has been created, what scientists and researchers are saying to us now, is that there are essentially four possibilities in terms of how this shroud could have come about. One is that perhaps it is a medieval work of art, an extraordinary work of art, admittedly, and there are theories that say that this was the work of a master artisan in medieval times and that there was no body within the shroud. So that's one possibility we must consider. The second possibility is that this may in fact be the body of a man who has been crucified, although it was not Jesus. It may have been the body of a man that his followers crucified in what is called a custom crucifixion to depict the body of Jesus as a Savior in a positive light for those during that time who wanted to portray the miracle and the majesty of what the crucifixion could offer. So that is a theory that has been proposed. We must consider that theory as well. The third possibility is that it is in fact a random crucifixion of a first century man. It wasn't done necessarily by followers of Jesus. It just happened to be a crucifixion of a man in general. One of the things that makes it so interesting is according to the text and the traditions, many, many hundreds, if not thousands of people were crucified during about a 200-year period of the Roman rule. And to the best of our knowledge, none of those crucifixions has produced the effects on their burial shrouds that we see in the Shroud of Turin. So that is a question, then, if this is a random crucifixion, we've got to address and answer that question. And then the fourth, the last possibility, is the one that obviously is the most controversial. It's the possibility that we may actually be looking at the burial shroud of Christ, of Jesus of Nazareth. And when we see the face in the shroud for the first time, we may actually be seeing the actual face of the man, the historical Jesus. Well, there are many points of controversy, as you can imagine, regarding the authenticity of the shroud, the age of the cloth, the blood on the cloth, how the image was formed. Historically, in recent times, in the 20th century, there have been only two major studies that the church has allowed upon this shroud. The first of those studies was in 1978, and this is a study that we're going to speak about extensively in just a moment. It was called the Shroud of Turin Research Project. Turin, by the way, for those who are not familiar with the name, T-U-R-I-N is the word that I'm hopefully pronouncing here. The Shroud of Turin Research Project. The second study was conducted 10 years later. And this is interesting because it was done by a single scientist. So the first study was a team of over 40 researchers. The second study was by a single scientist. What has happened is in the second study that the carbon-14 dating was performed. And interestingly, the results of that date were awaited. And when they were released, they went around the world in less than 24 hours. And what that carbon-14 dating said from the 1988 study, it said that the shroud is too recent to have been the burial shroud of Christ. The carbon-14 dating study from 1988 says that the shroud dates to between 1260 and 1390 AD, making it much too recent for the time of Jesus. Well, in just a moment, we're going to talk about the controversial points of that study and why that study may not have been dating the cloth that they believe that they were dating. So a little point of interest in where we might be going here. The 1978 Shroud of Turin Research Project was highly publicized. 40 scientists from around the world representing 11 different fields of biology, 9 fields of chemistry, 8 fields of physics, convened in Turin, Italy for this study. They were given unprecedented access to the shroud. The church had never granted this kind of access before. 5 non-stop days, 24 hours a day over 5 days to gather the data amounted to over 122 continuous hours of the study. And the results of that study led to 5 years of research and over 150,000 man hours of study, all resulting from the information gathered during that 1978 Shroud of Turin research project. Well, the day the study began was a day of great festivities in Turin, Italy. The streets were lined with hundreds of thousands of people waiting for an opportunity to see the shroud. And the trucks from the airports and the ships backed up to the church with tons of equipment and wooden crates that was unloaded and set up for this unprecedented 5-day access to the shroud. It was with tremendous ceremony that the nuns, the sisters of the church, brought the shroud out. The press was allowed to come in as the covering of the shroud was pulled back, revealing the uncovered surface of the shroud for the first time in a very long time. And this marked the beginning of the study I'm going to share with you now. One of the first questions that comes up is to whether or not there is blood on the shroud. There have been some studies that suggest there is no blood on the shroud, that what we see, what we think is blood, is actually iron pigment from paints of an artist's brush. So one of the first studies was to test for iron oxide, and some of the places where it looks like there may be the greatest amount of either blood or iron oxide is around the head and the face of the man in the shroud. The damage, the wounds all around the crown and the head left large areas, light-colored areas, in the photographs. And the question is, are these actually blood or not? Well, when they were given the test for iron oxide, they in fact turned a rusty red, indicating that there is a tremendous amount of iron around the crown, in the hair, in the beard, the nose, under the eyes, and in the face of this man. And one of the things that makes it so interesting is that this iron oxide appears to have been in a liquid form. And we say that because there are creases in the shroud where this iron oxide appears to have run down the face of the man in the shroud. And when it reached the creases, it begins to flow following the lines of the creases. And this is something you wouldn't expect from an artist's brush, per se. Well, the use of ultraviolet light is what really tells the story here. Because ultraviolet light, when blood is found in the presence of ultraviolet light, whole blood will not show up. Whole blood does not fluoresce in the presence of ultraviolet light. However, blood serum does. You know, when you or your children, when you fall down and you scrape your elbow or your knee and that wound begins to heal, the clear liquid that accumulates around the edges of the wound to begin the healing process, that is what is called blood serum. And this is the stuff that shows up under the ultraviolet light. Well, what happened was when the shroud was exposed to the ultraviolet light, it indicated there was a tremendous amount of blood serum, not only on the face of the man in the shroud, across his arms, down his chest, across the front and the back of his legs and his torso, the man appeared to be bathed, covered in blood serum. And the question then became whether or not it was human blood. When we were looking at the image of the shroud, it becomes clear that whoever the man in the shroud was had a large wound in his side, just below his heart and around his rib cage. And it is this place where the researchers began to test the blood to see if it is human or not. And under microscopic photography, you can actually see that the fibers of the linen are impregnated with the blood, not the way an artist's brush would have left them on the shroud, rather the flakes of blood that have dried over time. Test results for the paints, because many of the skeptics said that this was paint from this medieval artist. I'm going to share with you the test results. Some of these sound a little technical, and I'm just going to share them the way they are, because the photoelectric spectrophotometry showed that there were no typical artist substances on the cloth. In other words, no paints, no pigments as we know them today. So that was one test for paint. ultraviolet fluorescence showed that there were no collagen binders, as we would expect to be seen as in the paints that we use today, as well as the paints that were used in ancient times. X-ray fluorescence showed no inorganic pigments present in the paints, and X-ray radiography showed no substances manually had been applied to the cloth. I'm going to repeat that. No substances appeared to have been manually applied to the cloth. So the scientists in the 78 team ruled out the possibility that the image on the shroud was formed by an artist or by an artist technique, whether it was a brush technique or perhaps a technique we don't understand. And they began then to test the areas for blood. And what they found was that the blood tests were positive for 13 indicators, including hemoglobins, including bile, including heme, serum, albumin, and bilirubin, all indicators that this is in fact blood on the shroud, that it is not an artist pigment, and human blood. So the question, the blood analysis summary, I'll just summarize for you everything that they found. Is there blood present? Yes, there is. Is it human blood? Yes, it is. So much of it that they were able to type the blood, and the blood type of the man in the shroud is an AB positive. AB positive. And the question that's come up in recent times is, was there any DNA available on the shroud? And the answer to this is yes as well. However, in 1978, when these studies were conducted, we didn't know what we know today about DNA. DNA analysis had not reached the stage where it is today, and the samples weren't really collected for DNA specifically. So what happened was that the scientists were actually using sticky tape, and they'd place the tape over these areas, pull the tape up to collect the materials to be tested. And it was in this process that although DNA showed up as being present, the DNA was broken. They were segments, fragments of the DNA. So to the best of my knowledge, as of this time, we have no good contiguous DNA samples from the shroud. In the 1978 strip findings that published in 1981, I'm going to read a direct quote from the scientists regarding the conclusions on the blood. This is a quote. "We can conclude for now that the shroud image is that of a real human. The blood stains are composed of hemoglobin and give a positive test for serum albumin," unquote. So this is what the researchers found, and it should have ended the controversy as to whether or not this image was formed through an artist's technique. The next level of the investigation was a level described today as essentially forensic pathology, because through enhancement techniques that are available now from places like NASA and the FBI, the image on the shroud was able to be enhanced in ways and bring out details that had never been seen before. I was gifted 63 images from the original shroud research project in the mid-1990s. I've shared them with a number of audiences over the last years. Especially around Easter time, I often have invitations on Easter weekend, Easter Sunday, to share the images of the shroud, and I'm happy and honored to do so because it is such a compelling visual body of evidence regarding something that happened to one of us. One of the images that surprises audiences every time is the number of wounds that this man sustained in his body and the degree that the wounds have penetrated his body. He has obviously undergone a flogging. Forensic pathologists can even tell what kind of an instrument is being used and how many different strands of leather with seashell fragments in the ends of the leather designed to gouge the flesh. How many strands were there for each of these? The number of the wounds and the distribution of the wounds tells us that whoever the man in the shroud was, he underwent a horrible suffering before his life completed in whatever way it completed in the shroud. Well, this information was shared with the deputy coroner and the forensic pathologist of Los Angeles County, California, Dr. Robert Buckland. And what he essentially has offered now is a forensic summary, post-mortem, of the man in the shroud based on the enhanced images that we see from the 1978 study. I'm going to share just a little of this. It's very extensive. I'm going to share just a few of these so you get an idea of what the forensic pathologist is saying. So the abbreviated report says, number one, evidence of blood flows are present from numerous puncture wounds on the top and the back of the forehead. Number two, beatings about the face, swelling is apparent over one cheek. Number three, the nose tip is abraded. The nasal cartilage may be separated from the bone. Number four, there are wounds in the left wrist. Number five, there are numerous scourge marks on the back and the front of the body. And these are the marks that result from the seashell fragments tied to the end of the leather thongs that we know were used in ancient times. Number six, the swelling of both shoulders with abrasions indicating that something rough and heavy had been carried within hours of death. Number seven, a pierce wound on the right flank through the diaphragm, penetrating into the thoracic cavity through the lung and into the heart. Number eight, the abrasion of one knee. Number nine, the puncture wound through both feet. The probable cause of death from this particular forensic study in a single sentence was estimated to be cardiopulmonary failure consistent with death by crucifixion. And this is a summary, a brief summary of a very extensive report from the deputy coroner and the forensic pathologist of Los Angeles County. The dating of the cloth itself. And again, this is a point of tremendous controversy. Because when we date the cloth, what we now have to ask is the question, which portion of the cloth is being dated? And that is an important question because of the following. What we know is that the original shroud has been modified at least two times in recorded history. Maybe more. We know of at least two times. In the year 1534, the back of the cloth, a new cloth was sewn into the back to give it support. It's called the Holland cloth segment. In 1534, the Holland cloth segment was added to, sewn into the back of the shroud to give it extra support. And in 1868, a blue frame was sewn into the shroud as well. So now the question comes up, when we go to date the fibers of the shroud, if the fibers had been taken from either one of these areas with more recent cloth being sewn at later times, and those in fact are the fibers that are dated, then the shroud will date to the time of those fibers rather than the original cloth. There's also evidence of contamination. What we know is that the cloth is covered with a mildew, which is an organic material. Carbon-14 dating works the way it works because it measures the amount of carbon in living materials, and once those materials are no longer alive, it takes into account how quickly that carbon-14 decays. Well, if the shroud is covered with a material that's still alive and it's still absorbing the carbon-14, then it's going to skew those results. So that's one piece of contamination. And the second is that we know that the shroud was in a fire in the early church in the 1500s. It was folded a number of times and placed into a silver box. And the box, although the shroud was saved from the fire was so close to the silver box that it actually melted the silver and scorched the edges of the shroud, and in that scorching created additional carbon on the cloth. And if this carbon in any way contaminates the samples that are taken, it will as well skew the readings on the cloth. So the summary from the 1978 study essentially says, number one, that there is no significant trace of any paint, ink, dye, pigment, or stains on the shroud. Number two, that the image is not the product of an artist. Number three, that there is blood, and it's human blood on the shroud. And that the dating of the shroud, number four, does not account for the contamination that distorts the results of those tests. For the newer cloths that were sewn in, for the carbon from the fire, and from the living mold, the material that was found on the shroud itself. So, this is what we now know about the shroud. The next question, and the question that everyone always asks so many times, is if all of these things happen, if that image isn't painted, and if there was a real man, and there's real blood, and that man was actually crucified, then what is it formed, the image, on the shroud of Turin? So the question now is, what form the image on the shroud. Over the years, a number of theories have been formed, and they include body oils from the body naturally decaying, or anointing oils from those who took the body of the man and cared for him after his crucifixion. Some have suggested the process of biological decay that for some reason happened differently in this case than has happened in any other case that we have on record. There have been the suggestions of painting or smudging, and there's even been the suggestion that someone in the medieval times created a very detailed, eloquently, masterfully done bronze statue of this man, heated the statue to a red-hot temperature, and placed the cloth over the statue to create the image that we see as the shroud. Well, all of these are possibilities. However, each of the image formation theories that I just shared has been systematically ruled out by the studies. So the key that is going to really tell us whether or not this shroud image is an authentic image of a man or not is whether or not it contains what scientists call living information. The question is the shroud image holographic? And here's what I mean by that. An image that an artist produces is a flat, two-dimensional image. It is found upon the surface of the medium where it is created. However, from something that has been living, when something living is covered with the cloth, the way that we're seeing the image of the shroud formation produced, it leaves what we call a three-dimensional image. And one of the ways that we can determine this is through a piece of equipment that NASA developed for the space program. It's called the VP8, Victor Paul 8 Analyzer, the VP8 Analyzer. Have you ever seen when the space probes that we develop, when they go to other planets, when they go to the moon or they go to Mars, for example, and the probe, before it lands, it's orbiting the planet, and when the images come back and we're seeing them on our television screen and the probe is going up over the cliffs and the mountains and down into the valleys and you're right there with it, you feel as if you are on an amusement park ride in Disneyland and you wonder, how do they get those pictures? Well, what they're doing is the probe is sending back information to the receivers at NASA. And in NASA, they are using this VP8 analyzer to convert the two-dimensional information into this living three-dimensional information. So it only works with something that is of nature, rocks, trees, plants, living things. If you take an X-ray, for example, which we believe is a very detailed way of looking in our bodies, an X-ray is a flat two-dimensional image, black and white, of something that is of nature, of a human body, of a human arm, for example. And you place this X-ray in the VP8 analyzer. Because it is an X-ray of something in nature, the arm becomes very three-dimensional. It looks alive, as if it's going to jump out from the screen. And in the same way, the Shroud of Turin. If it is simply an artist's rendering and it's placed in the VP8 analyzer, the shroud will look very distorted. On the one hand, on the other hand, if it is actually encoded with living information, if the shroud is of nature and not an artist's rendering, then it will become very, very three-dimensional. It will show depth. And this is precisely what the researchers were able to do. They took the image of the Shroud of Turin and they ran it through the VP8 analyzer, and lo and behold, the image carries so much information and it is so lifelike. It is almost more than three-dimensional. Everything on the cloth, the creases in the cloth become three-dimensional. The man's face, his body, all become three-dimensional to such a degree. It is such an accurate representation of who the man in the shroud was that from this 3D image, scientists have been able to actually estimate the height and the weight of the man in the shroud. His height was about 5 feet, 11 inches tall, and he weighed approximately 178 pounds. The scientists from the Shroud of Turin research team, in their findings, say of this 3D analysis, they say, and this is a quote, "Immediately, we recognize that the image must have been generated by some principle whereby body structure became encoded into the varying shades of intensity on the cloth." Sounds very technical. If you'd like to see more of this, this was from the ACS, Advances in Chemistry Journal, 1984, volume 205, page 447. And this is an example of where the general public hasn't had the opportunity to see this kind of information. What are they saying here? They're saying that whoever the man in the shroud was, there was a man, he produced that image, and the shroud image is produced as a holographic image. And one of the great mysteries of this, then, is the mystery I'd like to share next. If you take baby oil, for example, and you rub your arm with baby oil, and you take a paper napkin and drape it over your arm, and then you unfold that napkin, and you look at the places where the baby oil is on the napkin, the image of your arm appears very wide and distorted. And this is one of the questions of the shroud. Why, if this shroud image is in fact the image of a man who is crucified and the cloth was draped over his body, the way we believe it was draped over his body, there is absolutely no distortion. There is no distortion as if the image were created by body oils. What the physicists have said, and I'm just going to share with you a passage from one of the research documents. The physicists, the laser light and the quantum physicists that were asked to offer their input into the shroud, what they have said in their opinion is this, that to create the image with no distortion, as we see on the shroud, one of two things would have had to have happened. Either the body would have had to pass through the cloth itself to avoid distortion of the image, or the cloth passed through the body. And they leave it at that. They say they're not going to go any further because to do so is speculation. They're simply stating on a physical basis that is what happened in the shroud. So we've got to ask ourselves, what could create such a process? Well, a growing body of evidence suggests that the man within the Shroud of Turin had both knowledge and access to the wisdom of our relationship to the forces of creation. A knowledge that he demonstrated as a mastery that may be only solved by us acknowledging who we are and our relationship to the same forces of nature. There's an additional aspect of the study that I'd like to share with you. Over the years, I've taken groups into Egypt probably 18 times or so, and we've had the opportunity to go into a very sacred portion of Egypt, the Sinai Peninsula, the base of Mount Sinai, where there is a monastery that has existed continuously for 1,500 years. This monastery was built 1,500 years ago. It has never been overrun by another government or another army or turned into anything other than a monastery. And second to the Vatican, this monastery has the greatest collection of religious documents and icons before and during the time of Jesus. Well, among those icons is a spectacular painting. It is an icon that is on the wall in the main sanctuary in St. Catherine's Monastery, the base of Mount Sinai in Egypt. And what's so interesting about this is that the compelling image of the face is very, very similar to the rendition that the scientist and the artist created from the Shroud of Turin. The similarities are striking. So with computer analysis, scientists determined that there were a certain number of points that both faces had in common, just as we would match fingerprints from a reference in a file to one found on a doorknob. They were matching similarities, very precise physical characteristics on the two faces. And to the amazement of the researchers, even themselves, who were doing the study, what they found is that between the icon found in St. Catherine's Monastery and the face produced in the Shroud of Turin, there are over 250 match points that suggest that the two faces are one and the same. So the question, what does the image on the shroud say to us today? We know what it is. It was produced by a man. There is blood. There is human blood. It's AB positive. We know how tall the man was. We know what he weighed. We know perhaps what he died from. We still don't know who he is. However, his message may become clearer to us now. The evidence suggests that the image in the shroud, the formation, was deliberate and intentional. The evidence suggests that that image illustrates a deeper relationship between the forces of nature, physical matter, and human experience. And that the ability of our species, if one of us can tap the forces of nature and create the phenomenon that we see in the shroud, what it says is that we all have access to the forces of nature, perhaps in a way we're only beginning to understand. The shroud demonstrates the magnitude of that power within each of us. If one of us can do it, we all can do it. If one of us has the ability to access the forces of nature in that way, then we certainly can become greater than the suffering that we see in our world today. So perhaps the last and final question, who was the man in the shroud? Who was that man? What the scientists say is that the wounds of the man on the shroud are consistent with the gospel accounts of Jesus' ordeal. From the crown of thorns and the bruising in the face to the nail wounds in the wrist and the wound in the side and the fact that the legs are not broken. The scientific criteria to determine who the man in the shroud was. We know that there was blood, that it was human blood. We know that the description of the wounds, the pollen grains, the burial customs, all match those of historic Jesus. What we can say is that 4 out of the 5 criteria, or 80% of the tests, support the authenticity of the shroud as being Jesus' burial cloth. But one question now is the age. Although we've determined that the carbon-14 tests performed in 1988 may have flaws, the church has not as yet allowed new carbon-14 tests, or any other kind of dating test for that matter, to compensate for those. And I know that the petitions are in place, the requests have been made, and time will tell whether or not we have access to the shroud again to determine the actual date of the cloth. Aside from the date, all of the other criteria are consistent. And although we may never know his name, what we can say for certain is that today there's no scientific evidence that prevents the Shroud of Turin from being the burial cloth of Jesus of Nazareth. Perhaps the message of the Shroud is that to understand its mystery, however, we must look beyond the cloth itself. The Shroud of Turin recorded an event that 20th century and now even 21st century science has failed to explain. To understand that mystery, we must recognize a relationship that our own science is only beginning to understand. Western science today identifies all the events in our universe as being the result of only 4 forces of nature. And they say that these 4 forces of nature interact with one another in such a way as to create all the creation in the universe as we know it. As I mentioned earlier in our last program, those 4 forces are the forces of electromagnetism, gravity, and the strong and the weak nuclear forces. What's important about these 4 forces is that as different as they appear from one another in our world today, they all are directly linked to human emotion. And what this says to us is that very specific qualities of human emotion that we may embody within ourselves, through those qualities, we actually have direct access to the fundamental forces of the universe, and it is all done through our ability to feel. Feeling is the prayer. So the shroud may be the best evidence to date of that ability, of our ability to touch those forces of nature, just as the man in the shroud did, in empowering and life-affirming ways. So we must consider the possibility that the shroud may serve as a bridge between science and spirituality, and a key to the great mystery of our lives. Whoever that man in the shroud was, and we know that he was human, we know that he was one of us, the power that he demonstrated within his burial cloth came from within his body. Been preserved through the ages, perhaps, the message of the shroud is that the power within that man and the shroud that covered him nearly 2 millennia ago is a power that lives within each of us today as well. It's only by our acceptance of our personal relationship with creation that we can access the true meaning of our lives and the depth of our personal conversation with God. Well, in the study of the shroud, only time will tell.